The Prelude, Dawn Over the River Moscow, from Mussorgsky's Kovanshchina, in the restored orchestration by Dmitri Shostakovich, from a recording we'll tell you more about later in the program, Claudio Abbado and the Vienna Philharmonic, the Vienna State Opera. We play this now as prelude to our own conversation with a recent conductor and stager of that opera, Kent Nagano. Last week we spoke with Kent Nagano about orchestra conducting, especially with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. This week we're speaking with him about his new position as music director of the Bavarian State Opera, the opera company in Munich. It's a state opera because Bavaria was, of course, a kingdom. This is the old company of the two Richards, Wagner and Strauss, and recently Sir Peter Jonas and Zubin Mehta, now Kent Nagano and company. I'm your host and producer, Andrew Patner, and now to our conversation with Kent Nagano. You took up the post recently of music director of the Bavarian State Opera, and that will also include the festival in July that has taken place for several years there now, that sort of summarizes the opera season and even the history of the company, and also usually offers the opportunity for one or more new works, new productions. First of all, you're coming into this position, an organization that recently has been very intendant driven by Sir Peter Jonas, formerly of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra some years ago, artistic staff. And in fact, the new intendant won't even be starting until next season, I guess. So is this the one summer of the Nagano-only regime, or is this a transition period, or how do you see things taking shape for you all in Munich?
It's a very good question. The history of Munich has been very dynamic in terms of its leadership, and dynamic might be at times, from the historical perspective, a polite way of putting it, because there have been a few highly visible storms that have taken place in Munich. And I'm not speaking only about the recent past. I'm speaking when Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Ido Maneo wrote several letters trying to be able to secure a post in Munich, and subsequently did not receive the post. That was quite discussed, and as you could imagine. Or thinking of when Wagner was there and his life was in danger, because you know, there are many aspects of society who had deemed him a criminal at that point. And so the Munich history, the Munich tradition is filled with, with moments that would later be defined as changing the course of European music history as we know it. And with that being the case, in the most recent past, Sir Peter has been there and has led wonderfully for the past decade. And in fact, it's because of Sir Peter Jonas that I was invited to Munich for the first time, and we remain very, very close friends. And with his stepping down, it was going to be a tremendous challenge, whatever direction the house decided to take. I had been asked to come in as General Music Director to succeed Maestro Zubin Mehta, and spent a long time working together with both Sir Peter and Maestro Wolfgang Sawallisch to actively prepare how the bridge should be towards the future. And when the vacuum opened up of having no intendant, of course it was a concern to all of us. But I suppose it was a humbling moment for nearly everyone involved, because this great house now, as I was saying, the opera house itself is now 375 years old. The orchestra dates back 100 years earlier. In many ways, it's been described by people to me as a gigantic ship that, hopefully is not like the Titanic. Right. It's just such a very large vessel that travels. And yes, it can... It can reorient its position. It can reorient the direction it goes. But these reorientations take time, and they take an enormous amount of preparations to properly steer and guide the ship forward. And at the same time, the momentum that's involved is, I think one of the great legacies of Sir Peter was that he built a very, very deep professionalism within mm-hmm. the house. And by professionalism, I don't mean only technical ability. I mean a level of comprehension, of taste, of an obeying of aesthetics, a consciousness of history, and an absolutely top-flight ability to achieve certain goals and functions. That is such a wonderful, wonderful legacy that Sir Peter left behind him, mm-hmm. that the decision was taken rather than hastily summon a new intendant and be forced into a situation where we might have to make a compromise mm-hmm. and go down two or three levels. Rather, with the tremendous momentum of the house and the fact that in the past history, the house has been led by the general music director, we would go through a period, we would prepare ourselves to go through a period of time where the house would run itself mm-hmm. until a new intendant could come. And we were very lucky to get Mr. Klaus Bachler with us, and also very fortunate that it would only be a two-season wait until he could mm-hmm. come. So mm-hmm. this two-season bridge right now.
And he's coming from?
From Vienna,
right.
From the Burgtheater, mm-hmm. from the dramatic theater
right.
world. But of course, his influences on the team are already felt. Now we work together carefully to make sure that whatever we plan now won't have any sort of interruption or rupture potential, that it will just automatically then evolve into his first year. So I think these are the aspects of tradition that involve an enormous amount of creativity.
Mm-hmm. As coming back to what we were speaking about at the beginning, tell us a bit about the world premiere that will be a major centerpiece of the festival in late June, early July this year.
The premiere is by a composer whose name is Unsuk Chin, whose rise, I think, has been really very, very quick in the past few years in terms of her visibility, her recognition. 3 years ago, she won the very famous North American Grawemeyer Composition Award, which suddenly provided for her an enormous opportunity to have her works played regularly on an international stage. We've known each other for many years now. She's been writing pieces for me over, I guess, the past 6 years, 7 years. The piece that won the Grawemeyer Award, she wrote for the Deutsche Symphony Orchestra, my former orchestra, and myself.
In Berlin. Yeah.
In Berlin, the violin concerto. And since then, I personally have simply been amazed at her creative output. We began to speak together with Placido Domingo, whether or not she might be intrigued or inspired to write an opera for us in Los Angeles for the Los Angeles Opera Company, and she accepted that challenge and began to work. Because of various budgetary problems, we needed to realign our planning in Los Angeles over these past years. And Mr. Domingo was very concerned that somehow the premiere not be postponed, that the premiere should happen on schedule. So when I decided to go to Bavaria and the invitation from Bavaria came to me, the question was, would the Staatsoper agree then to overtake the premiere and present it as the opening for our summer season, which of course we enthusiastically did in Munich. It was endorsed by Placido Domingo. And so the premiere was transferred from mm-hmm. Los Angeles into Munich. And at long last, because the work has now been under gestation for over 2 years, the premiere will happen. Something we're very much looking forward to, based on the story of Alice in Wonderland, the very famous story. I've already seen sketches of the score because they've been performed as separate pieces in their own light over mm-hmm. the past 2 years. And I think that the writing style that we'll hear from Ms. Chin will be something so fresh, people will imagine that they've not ever heard anything like this before.
A part of the tradition, to use that word again, of Munich, is this unusual, even unsettling combination of being revolutionary and traditional or even reactionary. And there has to be a certain amount of going for broke, I guess, that here's an Asian American who's taking over as music director in this storied Bavarian house. Here's a Korean composer with American connections who is a woman and who has set Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland as an opera in English, and that this is going to be such a focus of what's going to go on this year. And knowing the way music critics in certain countries sometimes let politics influence or take over their reviews, it might be an interesting thing, or maybe they'll actually just listen to the music and respond to the opera.
One of the things that I think no matter what walk of life we choose, that's simply unavoidable is politics. I mean, it's just a part of human being and human nature. It's also, to a large extent, is simply uncontrollable. We may trick ourselves into thinking that somehow we're in control of all of this, but in the end, we're not. Things just tend to evolve as they're going to evolve. About the only thing we can control, and it's very little, really, is one, the standard to which we place before ourselves that we absolutely must achieve, a standard of performance. That's something that we can work towards, and we can make a clear decision how high we're going to place that bar and whether we're going to continue raising that bar. And secondly, how much we're willing to compromise in terms of the quality of what we offer our public. That also is something that we can try our best to control. It's very important in a place like the Bayerische Staatsoper, where, as I've mentioned before, at the Opera House, we've had a tradition of 375 years old. We've had music directors such as Orlando di Lassus. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was with us, Richard Wagner, Strauss. They all came not as old, established, traditional composers. Right. They came as unbelievably radical composers, mm-hmm. with the potential to shift the course of how we even think about opera today. It is important, however, that we somehow respect the fact that the past history of the Bavarian Opera Company has been one which has, for whatever reason, has tried very hard to systematically adhere itself to the highest standards possible. And with the choice of new music, it's even more important that one tries to be as uncompromising as possible, to select works that that somehow you feel you can share with the public with complete honesty, that it's a work that represents the greatest of human creative potential. And I feel that this concern is shared, fortunately, with my colleagues at the Bayerische Staatsoper. It's a tradition that began long before I came, mm-hmm. where enormous amounts of dialogue take place, enormous amounts of discussion, endless discussion.
I was about to say that can have a bad side to it too.
But somehow at the end of that discussion, when and if a consensus can be reached, and it can't always be reached, mm-hmm. That shared responsibility translates into a shared dedication and commitment. And that somehow brings a very, very strong and wonderful tension into the air of a performance. And I think has resulted in having quite a special contact with the public that we have in Munich. It's a public that Mozart wrote about. Mm-hmm. He commented on how enthusiastic and mm-hmm. energetic the public was. It seems to have been a very special relationship between stage and public since hundreds of years now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's based upon, I think, non-compromise. So we'll see. I mean, your comments are fully in order. I completely not only sympathize with what you've described, but also I've thought about it quite a bit.
Yeah, I would imagine. Lastly, at least for today, maybe we can hear something from you about Montreal. Not an American orchestra, not a European orchestra. An important history. Recently, a long association with one conductor, Charles Dutoit, which ended somewhat unexpectedly, even abruptly. And another opportunity, as you were saying earlier, to think about the future as much or more as thinking about the past.
It is really very special to be working in the province of Quebec, and specifically in Montreal. I've never experienced anything like it in the past. Coming from North America, being an American myself, growing up on the West Coast, we in Northern California think that, you know, we've experienced everything, and this is so hilariously false, but we're still nevertheless surprised when we find out that In fact, our experiences are really limited compared to what other places in the world have to offer. First of all, North America is very young if you compare it to European history. And there are both advantages and disadvantages to that. And both are very striking and very real. But how does it relate then to ideas of culture, ideas of aesthetic appreciation, ideas of identity? Well, in Quebec, they're the oldest part of North America. Together with Jamestown, Quebec will celebrate its 400th anniversary, its birthday this year as a city. So its roots go far, far, hundreds of years back. The curious thing about Quebec is that they have maintained French as the prevailing language. Of course, everyone is bilingual. Everyone can speak English as well. But through the French language comes a certain rhythm, because language and the rhythm of language has very much to do with how our social constructs are put together, how we relate to each other.
Absolutely.
The rhythm of society. And also through the French language comes an almost subconscious tie with France and with Europe in large. And with this tie comes a certain closeness or sensitivity to European aesthetics. You can feel it as you walk around the streets of Quebec, or you can feel it in Montreal, simply not only in how people relate to each other, but the things that people tend to enjoy. Cirque du Soleil, for example, is a very, very special Quebec creation.
Right.
The jazz festival is something very, very special.
Right.
The museums that are there, the street life that exists is very, very special. You don't find it anyplace else. And of course, the style of speaking French has nothing to do with how French is spoken in France at all. It has been said that it's an area which has the wonderful aesthetic aspects of Europe, but with the practicality and know-how and getting things done of North America. It's the combination of both. It's also been called by, I've read this in articles, as a province where there's a perpetual identity crisis. Are you European or are you North American? I couldn't imagine a more stimulating atmosphere to be in if one has chosen the great European classical literature as one's repertoire, to have this area as a place for expression and exploration, because certain sensitivities are very, very heightened there. And also the differences between not only the United States of America, but the rest of Canada are so pronounced.
I was wondering if your contract didn't allow you to say the word Canada, because that's the first time you used it. But okay.
So we've just completed our first tour. The orchestra has stepped back from touring now for a number of years. As you recall, with Maestro Dutoit, touring was a regular part of taking Montreal Symphony Orchestra out of Quebec and exposing it to the rest of the world. Orchestra hasn't really toured in 5-7 years now. So our first tour we decided would be a pan-Canadian tour, mm-hmm. to reintroduce ourselves first to Canada to see what that was like. And it's an unusual tour because I asked that we go up to the Arctic Circle, and we did. Went way up to the Arctic and then went from east to west, as far west as Vancouver and as far east as Newfoundland.
Wow, you really did
so
span it.
So really spanned all of Canada. And it was, I think, a wonderful rediscovery of the orchestra, not only of ourselves, but also a reintroduction to Canada, of a part of Canada that sometimes is thought of as only a provincial center. But no, it reintroduced it as an artistic dynamo, as an artistic force. It was really, I think the words that many of my colleagues in the orchestra were using was a renaissance, a new beginning, a new mm-hmm. awakening. Mm-hmm. And it's an exciting time there right now.
We look forward to hearing them and you when you tour down here south of the border to Chicago and the United States of America. One postscript, through all of your travels and appointments and obligations and opportunities, you have remained loyal to the orchestra you grew up with, the Berklee Symphony Orchestra. And you recently, I think, announced that you would, after how many years, be stepping down as music director. I guess you're still too young to be emeritus, but you will be laureate or you will be something with Berklee. But maybe you could just say a little bit about this unusual thing where the one U.S. orchestra that you have had this long connection with is a small hometown orchestra.
Yes, this is the Berklee Symphony that you're referring to, and it is the first orchestra that I had right out of school, and with whom I, well, as you said, literally grew up with all this time. The orchestra is an extraordinary group of people that has somehow maintained a vital part of the community, of the larger Bay Area community. Not only as a personality and as a character, but also as an artistic force. Like many organizations in the world, not just in America, but in the world, we've had our share of financial problems in the past. Many, many times came close to needing to consider whether or not we would close our doors or not. Somehow, through the pluckishness and the innovation and creativity of the orchestra and of the community, the orchestra was always able to trampoline back and somehow with each return was stronger than it was before. After a certain period, it is important for an orchestra to have different experiences, different leadership, different directions. But I was always very concerned that at a certain point, it was a very real possibility that if I stepped away from the orchestra mm-hmm. with my fundraising skills and community connections, that the orchestra would really go down permanently and never come back. I think what's been extraordinary is that for the past 8 years now, the orchestra has achieved not only financial stability, but financial security. The playing of the orchestra with that financial security and community support has been able to expand, increase in its range and its abilities in a dramatic way. It was the first time that I ever felt I could step down mm-hmm. and watch the orchestra continue to grow without me. And that, to me, was really important somehow to not let the orchestra down. So, yes, in 2 years' time, I will have been there for 30 years, if you can believe that. And I'm a part of the orchestra during these two transition years to help select the person who will carry on the tradition beyond me. But I'm, as I mentioned before, the biggest difference, why now instead of earlier, I feel the orchestra has now grown to be a very, very strong and viable, solid institution in the Bay Area. And I can step back and be fully confident that the orchestra will continue to grow in different directions beyond me.
Well, someone who you can hear is very interested in the growth of his own mind and experience, that of the musicians he collaborates with, and the audiences that he and his colleagues perform before. Kent Nagano, certainly one of the most interesting and interested conductors that we have the privilege of having to hear and to observe and to listen to today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I'm very excited personally to be able to hear what you're going to be doing in June and July in Munich, and I hope others also will be able to hear that and other things you're up to in the years to come.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
Recorded in May at Orchestra Hall with the assistance of Eric Arunas, I did indeed get a chance to attend the Opera Festival of the Bavarian State Opera in Munich earlier this month and saw a pile of operas, most exciting the world premiere that we had discussed with Kent Nagano there of Unsuk Chin's Alice in Wonderland. Unfortunately, I'm not able to broadcast any of the musical excerpts that I do have of that for copyright reasons, but I hope that we can do a program dealing with Unsuk Chin, George Ligeti, her teacher, and the whole effort to make an Alice in Wonderland opera sometime in the future. Other highlights, Edita Gruberova, 60 and a half, as Queen Elizabeth in Donizetti's Roberto Devereux, and this coming just after the death, of course, of Beverly Sills, who had made that role and who had presented it 37, 38 years ago at New York City Opera, adding a degree of historical resonance and poignancy. A Wagner gala with Plácido Domingo, René Papa, Waltraud Meyer, a Salome with Angela Dunok, a brief opera by Wolfgang Rim that wasn't really much, an Alcina with Vasilina Kesarova, and then the first opportunity I've had to see a full live production of the Shostakovich revision renewal orchestration of Mussorgsky's Kovanshchina with the great chorus of the final scene by none other than Igor Stravinsky, of course, famously recorded in 1989 by Claudio Abbado for a 1990 Deutsche Grammophon release that remains a standard, but rarely presented live for a number of reasons. The theatricality of this work is much more in the music than in the action, and it has a very weird fifth act and final act where members of the Old Believers within transitional Russia, the time of the rise of Peter the Great, decide that they will commit mass suicide, which also, of course, includes murder when you consider that this is going to include the children and the elders, and they meditate on how they're getting ready for the next world. It's almost like a Jonestown scene, you might say, but musically, it sure is beautiful, and it's still ringing in my ears from Kent Nagano's production in Berlin at the National Theater there on the Max Joseph Platz in Munich. But let's hear from the Abbado DG recording with the Vienna State Opera, the Vienna State Opera Chorus, the Slovak Philharmonic Chorus of Bratislava, the Vienna Boys Choir, and, well, everyone else is dead at this point in the opera, but we'll hear as Dosife, the leader of the Old Believers, Paata Burkuladze, whom I actually heard as Kovansky in Munich, the great Mariana Lipovšek, the great Slovenian mezzo as Marfa, and Vladimir Atlantov, I think I also heard him, as Prince Andrei Kovansky. The last act of Kovanshchina, pay special attention to the final scene. You will hear the work of Igor Stravinsky.
Thank you.
the fifth and final act of Modest Mussorgsky's Kovanshchina in the renewed orchestration of Dmitri Shostakovich, the addition of Pavel Lam, the final scene by Igor Stravinsky. The historic 1989 recording for 1990 Deutsche Grammophon release, Claudio Abbado and Forces of the Vienna State Opera, with Pata Burkuladze, Mariano Lipovcek, and Vladimir Atlantov, the surviving soloists after the various murders that have taken place in the earlier acts of this opera. This bringing to an end our program, our second of two parts, conversation with Kent Nagano, the new music director of the Bavarian State Opera in Munich. We'd like to thank Eric Arunas for recording that interview, Matt DeStefano for making the program sound great, Helen Camioner of New York and Munich for putting all of this Munich business together. Thank you so much, Helen. Our funders, Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought of this or any of our programs. Drop us a line at rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.